Couple of things before we get started, and I'm assuming and hoping that this is all working right. We'll see. We've got, for those of you who didn't pick up your papers during the week last week, the first paper on the uninsured, the teaching assistants have them here, and at the break we'll be happy to give you your paper back. Just tell them what group you're in. We have them divided up by group, group number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, on through 12. We're also going to be collecting at the break today the papers that you wrote on ERISA and the right to sue. I think most of you, I mean a number of you had questions on them, and I think we responded hopefully to all your questions. This is not sounding so good to me, but it'll have to do. Getting better, okay. The goal today, what I want to do today is spend a little bit of time before we get, if you look at the syllabus, on the syllabus today is sort of publicly managed care. But I want to lead into the story of publicly managed care by talking about a subject that we already talked a little bit about earlier in the semester, and that's community health centers and the community health center movement here in the United States, and the evolution of the community health center movement here in the United States. Because community health centers are, I think, both an interesting story in terms of the politics. I mean, it's as we talked about when we talked about the uninsured, there are a lot of folks these days who say, it doesn't make all that much of a difference, say some folks, that we have 45, 50 million Americans who lack health insurance. Because at the end of the day, everybody can get health care, either from a community health center or a public hospital or a public health clinic. Clearly, there are many who suggest that that's a short-sighted view, that the kind of health care access people get through the medical safety net is inadequate, is not good enough, you get care too late, you don't get preventive care you need, you don't get the specialty care you need, and the like. But there's an important debate about the role of the medical safety net here in the United States, and not just around the uninsured. This is a debate that involves sort of the delivery system more generally. And this is a debate that's also very important to the debate over managed care, particularly the debate over publicly funded managed care through Medicaid in particular. So it seems to me it's important to understand community health centers. It's important to understand the community health center movement. It's important to understand how community health centers and public hospitals have played a role in the evolution of publicly funded Medicaid managed care. And so my goal today is to talk about the evolution of community health centers, to talk about the current status of the community health center movement here in the United States, then to talk about the various eras through which Medicaid managed care initiatives have gone through. And then in conclusion, I want to talk a little about some of the kinds of administrative or managerial challenges state and city officials face when they're actually trying to implement managed care initiatives. So that's the goal for today. Then next week, we're going to talk a little bit about long-term care when we start. But then we're going to have another breakout session for the second half of class next week. And during that breakout session, I'm going to ask you to wear the hat of a Medicaid managed care, or it doesn't even have to be Medicaid, of a managed care administrator, a government publicly funded managed care administrator. And I'm going to ask you a series of questions and have you walk through those questions. So that's the game plan for this week and next week. I hope everybody had a good break. I hope everybody's all caught up, as I said, on everything from basketball to Survivor to 24. And ready, a prison break is starting tonight. You're going to miss that because you're going to be here in class. Sorry about that. That's where we are. Any questions before we get to, you can see what I mean, I suppose I really should be worrying about health policy and all my, non-public health hours, but I have all these other things to worry about. Any questions people have before we get started? Okay, done. Now, the community health center movement is actually rooted very deeply in the civil rights movement here in the United States. And so on this subject, as with so many other subjects during the course of this semester, what we need to do is to go back in time, 100, 200 years, and then work our way forward. So that's what we're going to do yet again tonight. And where we're going to start tonight is with the end of the Civil War. Civil War ends. Slavery is officially and legally abolished. We enact the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendments to the United States Constitution. The 13th Amendment bars slavery. The 15th Amendment essentially guarantees everybody the right to vote. And the 14th Amendment essentially says that no state shall deny any person either the equal protection of the laws, nor shall any state deny any person life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Those three amendments, known as the Civil War Amendments, were one of two ways in which the victorious North decided it was going to try to enforce the end of slavery in the South. So the first route toward ending slavery was basically to say, legally, slavery violates the Constitution, slavery is illegal, and slavery is therefore abolished. And the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment are designed to produce those purposes. At the same time, the Northern government also left military troops in the South to physically enforce the end of slavery and to usher in what would be known as the era of Reconstruction, in which there would presumably be a new South with freed slaves, equal rights among black and whites in the South, equal economic opportunity, presumably, and a whole new world. So it was through a combination of Union troops remaining to enforce the end of the Civil War and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and the legal strictures struck down or set down in those amendments that marked the end of slavery and the end of that period. As everybody in this room knows, both of those efforts, both the effort to use the Constitution, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, and the effort to enforce the end of slavery with Northern troops, came to an end fairly quickly. In the case of the Northern troops, and I think we may have discussed this earlier in class, in 1876, there's a presidential election between Rutherford B. Hayes of Ohio and Samuel Tilden of New York, two governors. Very close election. Tilden wins the popular vote, but it's unclear who won the Electoral College vote. Ends up going to a special commission in Congress. A lot of political machinations and maneuvering go on, all sorts of under-the-surface activities take place, and in effect a deal is worked out under which certain Southern congressmen agree to support Rutherford B. Hayes in his bid to become president in exchange for his promise to pull the troops out of the South, the Northern troops out of the South, upon his election. 1876, as a result, Hayes is elected president by Congress, pulls the troops out of the South, and Reconstruction ends. At that point, Southern legislatures begin enacting all sorts of what are known as Jim Crow laws, all sorts of segregation laws, basically creating or putting into legal words what Southerners had been living by for the previous 100 years, a two-tier society in which there's clearly articulated segregation, there's clearly articulated separate schools, separate accommodations, separate housing, separate neighborhoods, separate transportation systems, and a segregated society from top to bottom. The question then arises, well, how could the South do this all? How could the South and the Southern legislators enact segregation laws? How could they enact Jim Crow laws? How could they have separate schools, separate transportation systems, and the like, given the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which says that no person shall be denied the equal protection of the law, and nobody shall be denied due process of law. I mean, nobody shall be denied life, liberty, and property without due process of law. So the legality of Southern segregation statutes is thrown into question at that point, under the 14th, in particular the 14th Amendment. 1896, in the case of Plessy versus Ferguson, the United States Supreme Court holds that segregation is legal, that separate but equal is legal, and that the 14th Amendment does not bar separate but equal, presumably equal, hypothetically equal facilities. So that it's perfectly legal under this Civil Rights Amendment. It's perfectly under the Civil Rights Amendment, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, it's perfectly legal, says the United States Supreme Court, to have segregation of all sorts in the South and elsewhere. Interestingly enough, and this we did talk about, and sadly enough, this we did talk about when we were talking about Franklin Roosevelt, shortly after the Plessy decision in 1896, we begin primarily in the North what's known as the Progressive Era. This was an era early in the 20th century in which northern states in particular begin enacting a series of laws that are designed to clean up the American workplace. There were a series of journalists and novelists and others who'd written books in the late 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s, pointing out the horrendous conditions under which many immigrants and others were working in factories, primarily in the North, in New York and Baltimore and Chicago. There were many allegations that big monopolies were acting in a very corrupt fashion across the country. There were many allegations that big city politicians in New York, and Chicago, and Baltimore, and elsewhere were completely dominated by party machines, and there was simply corrupt government going on through a whole variety of ways. So there were all sorts of allegations, and really for the first time in American history, in the early 20th century, there was a movement, as I said, a movement known as the Progressive Movement, spearheaded by writers such as Upton Sinclair, who wrote The Jungle, and other muckraking journalists and other legislators of all sorts, Hiram Johnson in California and others. There was a movement to clean up the business community, clean out corruption in politics, and create a new and better society, at least in the northern states where this was concentrated. And so, early in the 20th century, many state legislatures in the North began enacting all sorts of laws, such as minimum wage laws, basically saying if you're going to employ somebody in a factory, you have to at least pay them a decent minimum wage, such as maximum hour laws, basically saying you cannot just require your workers to work for 18 hours straight in the factory without any break at all, such as worker compensation laws, which require that if somebody is hurt on the job, you provide them with some basic benefits to enable them to get back on their feet and get back to work. A whole host of laws, such as laws regulating the conditions of factories. Now, these laws were just one element of the progressive agenda. There also were efforts to clean up political corruption, to require direct primaries, to give secret ballots so that the nominees for political office would be elected via secret ballot as opposed to being elected in the cigar, quote-unquote cigar-filled back rooms of political machines. There was the creation of civil service, which was designed to ensure a government bureaucracy in which jobs were awarded based on merit as opposed to being awarded based on political affiliation. There was a whole host of laws, but the ones that were particularly upsetting, particularly concerning, particularly challenging, and particularly difficult to the business community were the laws that required the cleaning up of the workplace, the laws that restricted monopolies, and the laws that required minimum wages, maximum hours, workers' comp, and the like. And so the business community, early in the 20th century, started going to their lawyers and asking their lawyers, geez, does the state of New York really have the right to tell us that we have to pay our workers at least $5 an hour if they're going to be working for us? Does the state of New Jersey really have the right to say that we have to give somebody a break after 8 hours of work with us? Does the state of Pennsylvania really have the right to impose, to require workers' compensation laws? Don't these laws violate our rights as employers? Don't these laws violate our ability to enter into contracts with our employees? Don't these laws violate our constitutional rights? And their lawyers took the cases, and looked at the law books, and looked at the Constitution, and said, well, you know, there is this 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment says that nobody shall be deprived of due process. Nobody shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And the lawyer said, you know, maybe we can argue that minimum wage laws, maximum hour laws, and worker protection laws are all part of the liberty that employers and employees have, or are all part of the contract rights that employers and employees have, and that states cannot regulate them under the 14th Amendment. And in a series of cases, early in the 20th century, early in the early 1900s, a number of courts, including the United States Supreme Court, a number of courts began to strike down state progressive era legislation as unconstitutional, as violative of the 14th Amendment, suggesting that workers who wanted to work for less than a minimum wage and employers who wanted to pay them less than a minimum wage had a constitutional right to enter into whatever agreement they wanted without the state of New York regulating that relationship. And so, ironically, the 14th Amendment, which had been enacted in an effort to protect the newly freed slaves in the South, by the early 20th century, was being used instead to protect the business community throughout the nation, and was not being used to protect newly freed slaves. Those decisions created a judicial theory known as substantive due process. Again, if you think about the 14th Amendment, what it says is you can't deny somebody life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Well, maybe it's true, said state officials. Maybe it's true with denying employers, employees a little bit of their liberty by saying that they have to be paid a minimum wage. But we've had plenty of due process. We had plenty of hearings. We decided that there's a societal interest in enacting minimum wage laws, for example. But what the court said is that the due process clause involves more than process. It also involves substance. And as I said, a number of courts began striking these laws down. Moving ahead 30 years, and this part of the story we did cover, so I'm not going to cover it in any depth at all. Franklin Roosevelt becomes president. And once again, the United States Supreme Court poses a real threat to Roosevelt's perception of what the federal government ought to be doing to rescue the nation from economic depression. Franklin Roosevelt is very upset that the Supreme Court begins striking down pieces, elements of the New Deal legislation, saying that that legislation goes beyond the authority of the federal government. And so, as we talked about in this class a few weeks ago, Roosevelt threatens to pack the court, there's a big constitutional crisis, and ultimately the court relents. And in 1935, the court essentially abandons any notion of substantive due process. And the courts basically say that when it comes to the economic regulation arena, when it comes to the state legislatures or the Congress passing laws that affect the economics of the United States, whether it's tax laws, whether it's minimum wage laws, whether it's any kind of law affecting the regulation of the United States, of the economic infrastructure in the United States, we, the Supreme Court, we, the courts, are going to allow the Congress and allow the legislature to do pretty much whatever they want, so long as there's some rational basis for that action. But we're going to interpret rational basis very expansively, so that basically Congress and the states, when it comes to economics, can do pretty much whatever it wants. ...180-degree shift from the decisions in the early 20th century that struck down minimum wage laws and the like. At that point, and I know you're probably wondering, what the heck does this have to do with community health centers, and what the heck does this have to do with health policy and management? But bear with me, we're getting there. At that point, the United States Supreme Court, in effect, begins to say to itself, what should our mission be? What's our role? What's our place as an institution in American politics? If our mission is not going to be to protect the business community against economic regulation, is there another, is there a different, is there a better mission that we can have, that we can use, that we can rely on to make us, to turn us into once again a relevant institution in the politics of American democracy. And without turning this into a course in constitutional law, the courts in the 1930s and the 1940s begin to fashion a new kind of argument, a new kind of role for themselves in American politics. The Supreme Court begins to say, you know, if we're going to let the Congress and the states do pretty much whatever the Congress and the states want in the arena of economics, that doesn't mean we have to let the Congress and the states do pretty much whatever they want in any arena. And what we want to do, says the court, not in so many words, but through a series of cases over time, what we want to do is we want to look extra closely, extra carefully, with extra scrutiny at two kinds of cases. We want to concern ourselves with the constitutionality of two kinds of cases. The first kind of case that we want to concern ourselves with, says the court, are cases in which either the Congress or a state is infringing upon a fundamental right that American individual citizens have. What would be an example of a fundamental right?
Roe v. Wade.
We'll get to Roe v. Wade. This is how we get to Roe v. Wade. But, excuse me? Well, it's any right that is actually set forth in the Constitution. So, for example, if you look at the First Amendment to the Constitution, the First Amendment says, you know, no state shall infringe upon, you know, free speech, religious liberty, right of association, etc. Those are all fundamental rights. The Constitution clearly says there's a fundamental right to freedom of speech. There's a fundamental right to freedom of association. There's a fundamental right to religious freedom. Now, does that mean that government could never infringe upon those fundamental rights? No. I mean, the old classic case, I suppose, is, you know, if you're in the crowded movie theater and you falsely yell fire, well, you can't do that. I mean, there are limits on free speech. There are limits on freedom of expression. And it's those limits that the courts have spent a lot of time trying to figure out over the last 50 years. But what the court basically says is that where there's a fundamental right infringed upon, we're going to look very, 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 very closely at any infringements upon those fundamental rights and only allow those infringements in the rare cases when there's a compelling state interest to do so. Now, during the 1960s and 1970s, the court used fundamental right doctrine, and someone mentioned Roe versus Wade. Anybody know what the argument was in the original decision by Blackmun in Roe versus Wade? Excuse me?
Privacy.
I mean, there had been a series of cases before Roe v. Wade, in which the court had begun to argue and begun to suggest and begun to insist that within the Constitution somewhere, even though it did not say so explicitly, within the Constitution somewhere was a constitutionally protected right to privacy over one's own body. Doesn't say that per se in the Constitution. And that's why Scalia and Thomas and other sort of originalists, I suppose, would say it's not there. But Brennan and Marshall and others basically said, well, even though it's not explicitly there, there's this implicit right to privacy. What did the court then say about the right to privacy? This is a little bit of a tangent in Roe versus Wade, but anybody know? I mean, prior to Roe, what happens tomorrow if Roe versus Wade is abolished? I mean, is overturned tomorrow? What does that mean about the right to an abortion? Goes back to the states. So basically, what happened in Roe versus Wade is you had a Texas law, which made it a crime for a doctor to provide an abortion. So the issue in Roe versus Wade was whether or not that law was constitutional, that Texas law. And basically what the court said, and I don't want to take this through, you know, the 30, 35 years of abortion litigation post Roe versus Wade, but in Roe what the court basically said is, you know what, there's a constitutional right to privacy that women, pregnant women, have over their own body. But there's also a potential state interest in protecting the rights of the viable fetus, said the court. And so what the court in Roe said was that during the first trimester, a woman's right to an abortion clearly trumps the right of the fetus, which is not yet viable. And so there's pretty much an unfettered right to an abortion in the first trimester. What the court in Roe said was that in the last trimester, once the fetus is quote-unquote viable to live outside the woman's body on its own, then essentially the right to the fetus trumped the right to the woman unless the woman's life was in danger. So you pretty much cannot have an abortion in the third trimester unless the woman's life was in danger. And in the middle trimester, the court said, we don't really know, so we'll leave it up to the woman and her doctor to decide whether or not it makes medical sense for the abortion to take place. So, but as long as the doctor signs off, it's allowed. So basically you have this balancing act between the right to privacy and the rights and the state's interest in regulating abortions. And then there's been obviously, you know, 35 years of litigation over what that has meant since. But that all involved right to privacy. Another case involving rights, involving medical access to health and welfare benefits, involving fundamental rights. And this comes up in welfare and in Medicaid. One thing you know, because we've talked about it a lot over the semester, is that in both welfare and Medicaid program, there's extraordinary variation among the states in the benefit levels of coverage and in the eligibility levels for coverage. So if you're a resident of Mississippi, you may not get the same kind of benefits that you would get if you were a resident of New York. And so in the early 1960s, New York State got very concerned, or New York State policymakers got very concerned about what they would call the welfare magnet effect, which was the argument that people were moving to New York to get the generous health and welfare benefits that New York offered. And that you had people moving from the South and from elsewhere to get the generous health and welfare benefits that New York offered. And so what New York wanted to do, and New York passed a law in the 1960s, or was challenged in the late 60s, probably was passed much earlier, but the law basically said that if you move from another state to New York, you cannot get health or welfare benefits in New York for at least a year. You've got to live here for at least a year. It was a durational residency requirement. The idea was to discourage people from moving to New York by suggesting they weren't going to get public assistance or Medicaid coverage for a year. advocates, legal service advocates and others wanted to challenge that law. On what basis do you think they were able to challenge it successfully? Immigration? Well, that's sort of. Yeah, I mean, the general idea was, but again, what they wanted to do was basically find in the, they wanted to make this into a fundamental rights case. So how would you define immigration? If you were trying to define a right that individuals have, what's the right that's being violated?
Freedom of movement.
Freedom of movement, absolutely. What the court decided in a case called Shapiro versus Thompson was that the New York state law violated the right of interstate travel that was guaranteed in the Constitution. Now again, if you read the United States Constitution, nowhere in it does it say there's a right to travel and to get equal welfare benefits when you do travel in one state versus another state. But the court in the 60s and the 70s basically said that right is implicit in the nature in the whole Constitution, and the violation of that right is grounds for striking down those laws. More recently, a number of states enacted laws which basically said, well, geez, all right, maybe we can't say you can't get welfare benefits or health care benefits in New York for a year if you've moved here from... I mean, the difference between this and immigration is these people weren't coming from a foreign country. They were coming from a foreign state. I mean, I know some people might consider New Jersey a foreign country, but I'm kind of liberal about New Jersey. I think New Jersey people are okay. You know, I don't have many friends from Jersey, but I still think they're all right. But in more recent years, this case came back to the United States Supreme Court in a different context. What a number of states tried to do in the 1990s was pass laws that said if you moved to New York, or if you move, see, as I say New York, you could tell where I'm from. If you moved to New York from another state, the benefits that you received in New York could not exceed the benefits that you would have received had you stayed in Texas or Mississippi or Alabama. So if in Texas or Mississippi or Alabama you were entitled to welfare benefits of $50, whereas if you were in New York you'd get $100, for your first year here in New York you'd only get $50. Those laws too were struck down by the United States Supreme Court as violating the fundamental right to travel. So beginning in the 1930s and 1940s, there was a whole line of constitutional inquiry and litigation that commenced around fundamental rights in the Constitution and around state and federal efforts to restrict or limit or infringe upon those fundamental rights. And whether it's abortions or welfare or housing or education, there's lots and lots and lots of litigation over those kinds of cases. That's one kind of case that the Supreme Court took under its wing beginning in the 1940s. I mean, the first example, just to give you one more example, the first example of that case, that kind of case, was a case in the early 1940s. This was the first time the court ever really did this sort of thing. In the early 1940s, there was a law in West Virginia that required all kids in school to stand up and pledge allegiance to the flag. I know I had to do that when I was a kid. I mean, it was just, you know, it was required, at least for us older folk. I don't know if it's still required. It's still required? You younger folk, do they still make you pledge allegiance to the flag? They do it, but it's not required. Okay. Well, there was a young Jehovah's Witness family in West Virginia who basically said that requiring that child to stand and pledge allegiance to the flag violated their religious beliefs. And that case made its way up to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court said, and what would be, if you were the lawyer for, just out of curiosity, if you're the lawyer for the state of West Virginia, and the question is there a compelling state interest in requiring kids to pledge allegiance to the flag, What argument might you make? Anybody want to make an argument on behalf of the state of West Virginia? You don't have to believe it, but, you know, this is like law school 101. What you believe is totally irrelevant.
Anti-terrorist.
Well, the comment was anti-terrorist movement. That's not at all far afoot. In the 1940s, what was going on in the 1940s? We were at war. You know, we were in the middle of World War II. And basically the argument that West Virginia said is, you know, this is, you know, our very way of life is, whatever our way of life is, but whatever that is in question, under attack, you know. I mean, the number of people that died during World War II is just staggering, staggering loss of life. And so West Virginia basically said, you know what, what we're trying to do is inculcate values of citizenship and morality and loyalty and allegiance to our country during a time of war. But what the court said was that interest, which would have met the rational basis test. I mean, that's not an irrational argument. And so if the test were, is what the state requiring rational? I can hardly move with these various things. I'm like a prisoner. Someday I'll actually, you know, this will be better. You'll have to come back and take the class again. And then you'll, just kidding. What was I saying? Oh, it's not irrational. But what the court said, that's not a compelling enough explanation. And therefore, you cannot require that kid, to violate his freedom of expression. You can't suspend him from school for not saluting the flag and reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. You have to let him just, I guess, sit there quietly or go out of the room or do whatever it is that folks do today. That's fundamental rights litigation, and we could spend weeks on fundamental rights litigation involving healthcare issues, among other things. The other kind of case that the Supreme Court began taking under its wing in the 1940s, however, and that the courts began thinking about seriously and looking at seriously, were cases in which state or federal laws violated the rights of groups that were considered to be discrete and insular minorities that had historically been excluded from the political process. The idea here... No. Either you got it or you didn't. Sorry about that. And I'm turning the podcast off. That's it. No. No. The idea here is...
Condense it.
Why don't you just say it more clearly? The idea here is, if basically what the court says is, we're a democracy. And in a democracy, we generally believe as a society that the majority should be able to make policy decisions. We generally believe in majority rule. And just because you're in a minority on a particular issue, just because you get outvoted in the political process, doesn't mean you should be able to go running to the court and say, I need protection from that evil majority. However, said the court, if there is a group in society which has historically been excluded from that political process, which has not been given a fair shake in the American political system, and if that group is harmed by a piece of legislation, then we, the court, as part of our mission, have a special obligation to look very carefully and very closely at that legislation to make sure it's fair. Question. How is what constitutional? Well, again, the question is, you know, how do you interpret the 14th Amendment? This is all around the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment says that no state shall deny anyone the equal protection of the laws. And so the question is, how do you define equal protection of the laws? And so what the courts have said, and it's been, again, this is the kind of issue on which judicial scholars and others have spent a lot of time disagreeing and debating. But what the majority of the court began to say was that if there is a group, and the first group that became the example of this were blacks, African Americans. If there's a law, said the court, which infringes upon and harms and singles out in its impact African Americans, then we, the court, are going to look particularly closely at that law. Over time, there have been other groups which have tried to make the same kind of claim, that they too deserve close scrutiny and protection by the court. As a group, there was an argument in the 1970s and 1980s that laws that had an adverse impact on women should be looked at more closely by the court. There was an argument that immigrants, there was an argument that, you know, ranges of groups in the 60s and 70s began to say, we deserve special protection from the court. And again, you're right, you can't open up the Constitution and find a line in the Constitution that says what I'm just saying. Just like you can't open up the Constitution and find a line which says there's a right to privacy. So the question becomes whether or not by engaging, or one question becomes whether or not by engaging in this kind of judicial action, the Supreme Court in the 50s and 60s and 70s was engaging in what conservatives would call judicial activism, you know, that was creating rights and creating laws through the Constitution that went way beyond what the Constitution authorized. And clearly, there's been a 40-year debate over whether or not that happened. Yeah?
You had talked about, like, with the progressive era.
Right.
Like, that kind of being...
Protecting the business community, right.
Protecting the business communities, but also a lot of the laws that they were trying to enact were kind of restricted, like, to the northern states. So...
Well, I didn't say the laws were restricted. It was the North that was enacting those worker protection laws.
So I guess, like, the question I have is, how was this kind of new role that the Supreme Court was taking in terms of these two types of cases, was that going to be implemented? Were they thinking of this implementation as far as all states?
Absolutely, because certainly when it came to protection of what were known as discrete and insular minorities, or African American, for example, the primary arena in which we were talking about protection, the court was talking about protection, was civil rights and was segregation. And clearly it was the South that was being looked toward. And so the first kinds of cases in which the court became sort of the protector of a minority group was Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. In 1954, the Supreme Court overturned the Plessy case. Remember, Plessy, which had been enacted, or not enacted, which had been held, decided in 1896. I'm so glad this is just audio, not video. This is like, anyway, the Constitution, the decision in 1896, in the Plessy decision, said separate but equal is okay. But in the Brown case in 1954, the Supreme Court held that separate but equal is inherently unequal. That it to tell young black kids they have to go to a separate school from young white kids, even if the schools were of equal educational, had equal educational resources, which clearly they did not. But even if they had equal educational resources, to tell a black kid that he has to go to a separate school because of the color of his or her skin imposed what the court described as a badge of inferiority upon that kid, and therefore violated the fundamental right to equal protection under the law that that kid had. And so 1954, and believe it or not, here's where we're beginning to get close to the Community Health Center movement. We're starting to. I know you all wonder. It's only 6:30. Come on, relax. 1954, there is really, for the first time, optimism in the African-American community that there's an institution of American government which is going to fight for and protect the rights of blacks in the South. Clearly, the president whether it was Franklin Roosevelt or Dwight Eisenhower or Harry Truman, the president was not perceived as being a protector of civil rights. The Congress was dominated by Southern Democrats who clearly were not a protector of civil rights. And so the argument was, here for the first time, we have an institution of American government that's going to protect, that's now created this whole judicial philosophy, wherever they created it from, has created this whole judicial philosophy and this whole interpretation of the Constitution, which is going to strike down segregation in the South and which is going to lead to a new world and a new kind of world in the South and the United States more generally. That hope in 1954 was dashed in 1956. In 1954, the court decided Brown won. Brown versus Board of Education won. In 1956, the court decided Brown 2. And basically what Brown 2 said is, you know, we're a little worried there's going to be a revolution in the South if we actually try to impose desegregation by law, if the court gets way out ahead of the political process and tries to impose desegregation in the South. We're aware that most Southern states are completely ignoring our decision in Brown. Just like, remember when we talked about, if we talked about Marbury versus Madison in this class. Did we talk about Marbury versus Madison in this class? Who are you people anyway? What are we, you know? Anyway, forget it then. It's a whole other subject. But, you know, there was fear that, I feel like, I've been watching all this basketball play, and there's this commercial, which they've had about 9,000 times. I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's a commercial for, it's a McDonald's commercial, I think, in which it's supposed to be about how the McDonald's coffee, like, wakes you up, and you, like, feel the coffee in a way you never felt before. So there's, like, some husband guy, and he's, like, you know, he's sitting there, and he just had this cup of coffee, and he just realized that he's been married for 10 years to this woman, you know, because this coffee just, anyway, it's kind of like Marbury. If you saw it, if you were here for the Marbury story, you'd understand that, and if you saw the commercial, you'd understand that. But anyway, getting back to, I better stick to what I'm talking about here. What was I talking about? Brown 2 basically said that the Southern states can proceed with integration with what they called all deliberate speed. It basically said to the South, you can proceed with integration at whatever pace you want to proceed with integration. Integration's the law, but we're not going to require you to do it overnight. At that point, it became clear to civil rights leaders and others in the South that the Supreme Court had basically gone forward 2 steps, gone back 2 steps, and had basically said to the Southern leaders, you don't have to integrate. I mean, the term all deliberate speed, it's a oxymoron. What does that mean even? You know, it's hard to even know what that means. It means you go at whatever pace you want to go. Yeah?
Was that the first time that has been done since when the Supreme Court makes a decision and reverses itself so quickly on the grounds of states basically ignoring it?
Well, it's one of the first times when the Supreme Court has backtracked, although the Supreme Court did not reverse itself. It did not say that Brown was wrongly decided. It continued to say that integration is required under the Constitution and segregation is unconstitutional. That was a case, though, involving remedy, you know, and how you enforce the decision. And basically the court said it's up to the state officials to decide how quickly they're actually going to comply. It didn't say they didn't have to comply. It just said it's up to them to decide how fast they comply. At that point, 1956, 1957, civil rights leaders in the South basically found themselves in a situation again where the view was there was no help from any of the institutions of American government. There was no help from the presidency, there was no help from the Congress, And now, after hopes had been raised, there was no hope from the courts either, because the courts had pulled back. That, among other things, was one of the real triggers for what we would today think of and call the civil rights movement in the South. That led people like Martin Luther King and others to push for activity outside of the institution of government, institutions of government, to begin to exert significant pressure on the institutions of government, whether it was the Montgomery bus boycott that King led, and Birmingham boycotts and sit-ins and luncheons at Woolworths and marches, all the kinds of things that you and we would associate today with the civil rights movement. That increased activity, combined with television, which began showing sort of northern liberals what was going on down in the South, particularly as young northern kids would go down south and get in some trouble down there, that began creating the sort of national moral outcry. John Kennedy was elected president in 1960. He was a bit resistant to enacting a civil rights act, a civil rights law. He was hesitant about breaking up the New Deal coalition, which had gotten him elected, which basically was a coalition of urban ethnics, northern liberals, and southern Democrats. I mean, after all, that's why he had asked Lyndon Johnson to be his running mate, so that he can win Texas and win some of the Southern Democrats. So Kennedy was resistant. That's why in August of 1963, Martin Luther King led a march on Washington to try to put pressure on John Kennedy and Congress to pass a civil rights law. Kennedy was then assassinated in November of 63. Lyndon Johnson was elected in a landslide election in 1964. We talked a little bit about the ramifications of Johnson's landslide victory when we talked about the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid. But there is no doubt that the election of 1964 was one of the most fundamentally powerful realigning elections in American history. That election changed American politics. That election changed the political party system that we know of today. It was really after 1964 that Southern Democrats began leaving the Democratic Party, ultimately migrating to Richard Nixon in 1972. Fundamentally changed the coalition and the way American government politics works. Fundamentally changed the way Congress works. That election broke the Southern Democrats' stranglehold on Congress. Helped lead to the enactment of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965. That act fundamentally empowered the courts to become far more activist. I mean, just about all the cases that we just even talked about today, whether it's Roe versus Wade or Shapiro versus Thompson, or the busing cases and affirmative action cases in the civil rights arena, all of those cases came as the politics changed dramatically in the United States in the mid-60s as a result of that election. And that election also changed, almost equally important, if not equally important, two other things. There was, perhaps for a relatively brief moment in American history, but there was a moment in the mid-late 60s ushered in by the Civil Rights Movement, in which there was a changed view of poverty and the causes and the explanations of poverty. And there also was ushered in a changed view of federalism and the relationship between the federal government and the states. Let me start with poverty. From the days of the English poor laws that we talked about at the beginning of this semester, from the days of the English poor laws, the perception and the belief and the abiding philosophy in American politics was that, generally speaking, people are poor because they're lazy. People are poor because they don't want to work, because there's something fundamentally immoral about them, because they don't want to take care of themselves, because they don't want to get a job. That deserving poor, the concept of the deserving poor versus the undeserving poor, as we've talked about in this class, permeated and still does permeate much of the American welfare system. Franklin Roosevelt, in enacting the New Deal in 1935, bought into the concepts of the deserving poor versus the undeserving poor. In the mid-1960s, for the first time, sociologists and social welfare theorists and political philosophers and others and economists began to say, you know what? Poverty is caused, at least in large part, not by individual sloth, but by social conditions, by education systems, by job systems, by childcare systems, by housing systems, by healthcare systems. Poverty is caused by the system in which you grow up. And that while it may be true that 1 out of 100 will escape the social conditions in which he or she grew up, it is fundamentally unfair to say that the other 99 who do not escape those conditions stay where they are because they're lazy or immoral or unethical. And so the quote-unquote great society programs were premised on the argument, on the notion that what you have to do is not simply give the deserving poor some cash, whether it's a welfare benefit, a welfare check, or otherwise. What you have to do instead is give low-income people the services they need to enable them to escape poverty. And so the Great Society programs of the mid-1960s were programs designed to give services, not cash. What kind of services do you think I'm talking about here? Excuse me? Oh, go ahead, yeah. Medical services. Food stamps. Although even more than that, how do you help people get jobs? Yeah.
I was going to say employment training.
Job training. Programs, anybody else? Programs like Head Start. Give kids, you know, an opportunity to get a good education. Child care programs to give women an opportunity to get out of the house and work. Daycare programs, job training programs, education programs, health programs. You know, all initiatives designed to give people the tools, you know, to use the old cliche, instead of giving people a fish, to teach them how to fish. You know, to give them the skills to make it on their own. That's one fundamental shift that took place in the 1960s. A second fundamental shift had to do with federalism. And here the shift was to say, you know what, we don't trust the states anymore, particularly the southern states. And we don't trust the cities anymore, particularly these big corrupt political machines in Chicago and New York and Baltimore, etc. We here in the federal government instead want to have a direct connection, a direct relationship with community-based organizations. And so in the mid-1960s, the federal government began bypassing the states, began bypassing the local governments, and giving grants directly to community-based organizations to run education programs, job training programs, healthcare programs, daycare programs, legal services programs, and the like. The idea was to connect directly with community members. The federal government created something called the Community Action Program, which was designed to create all sorts of new programs and to give funding to low-income communities to let those low-income communities figure out what kind of services they need and implement those services in their communities. And so here, an hour and 10 minutes into the lecture, here is where the Community Health Center movement comes. The Community Health Center movement starts as an effort to give low-income communities and to give organizations in low-income communities some funding to begin and to create primary care health delivery systems which would be responsive to the needs and the goals and the desires of those community members and would be, in effect, an alternative delivery system, alternative system that would present a challenge to the big hospitals, the big institutional-based facilities, the academic medical centers, and the like. This was going to be, I mean, in 1965, you had simultaneously, in effect, Congress enact Medicare and Medicaid, the goal of which was to give the low-income folks and the elderly folks and the disabled folks a card which would allow them access to the existing mainstream infrastructure. But you also had the Community Health Center program initiated, which was not an insurance program, which was not part of Medicaid, but which was designed instead to create clinics in low-income communities that would be run by the members of those low-income communities. And in fact, even today, in 2006, a federally qualified community health center needs to have a board of directors in which more than 50% of the board is comprised of community members and patients. The goal was to bypass the states, to bypass local governments, and to give funding directly to local community members. Now, these kinds of Great Society programs, whether it's community health center programs, whether it's job training programs, whether it's daycare programs, whether it's Head Start programs, became enormously controversial. There were those who argued that, in effect, there's all sorts of fraud and abuse going on. Money is being wasted. Money's been given to community groups, and who knows what's happening to it. There were arguments that would suggest, that were suggesting, and headlines that were suggesting that gangs in low-income communities, whether it was the Black Panthers or the Young Lords or whoever, were getting grants to basically do whatever they wanted to do in local community local communities under the guise of providing social services. There was huge opposition from local political leaders because these dollars were bypassing local political leaders. And there's some truth to all of those kinds of allegations and all of those kinds of anecdotes. But it's also the case that the model of providing community-based services, whether it's healthcare, whether it's job training, whether it's daycare, whether it's Head Start, that model survives today and is, by most accounts, when done right, an enormously beneficial and helpful and useful model. All right, so community health centers are created in 1965. There's two of them in the first year, you know, one in Boston and one in Mississippi. The goal is, as I said, to create these clinics to provide health care to primary care to low-income communities run by the low-income communities themselves, figuring out what they want, what they need. And the creators of the community health center movement had enormously ambitious goals. Their goal was that by the mid-1970s, there would be over 1,000 community health centers across the United States serving over 25 million Americans their health care delivery needs. 10 years later, in the mid-1970s, there were only about 100, if not less than 100 of these, serving only about 1 million or 2 million Americans. So what I want to do now is, first we'll take a break, but then when we come back from the break, I'm going to talk about the various paths that the community health center movement has gone through over the last 30 years, and then talk about what those paths mean for the politics of delivery systems at local levels, what those paths mean for managed care, and what those paths mean for healthcare in the United States more generally. So we'll take a short break and then come back. I can have your attention. We're going to get started. Okie doke. So everybody should have handed in their second memo and gotten back their first memo. So if you didn't hand in your second memo, hand it in at the end of class. And if you didn't get back your first memo, I've got them up here, and we can give them back at the end of class. Okay. Now what I want to do is trace through the ups and downs that community health centers have had over the last 40 years and try to figure out with you why it is that this model is so popular and has such bipartisan support today, particularly when that has not, by any stretch of the imagination, been the case for most of the last 40 years. Okay, any questions, though, before I start on what we did before the break? All right, as I mentioned right before we took a break, the creators of the community health center movement had great expectations, had great ambitions, really believed that this delivery system model, small community-based primary healthcare clinics was going to be the wave of the future. And as I also mentioned before the break, 10 years into the program, expectations had been seriously dashed, diminished, disappointed. What do you think some of the problems were in that first period that community health center officials faced? Any ideas? Yeah. One issue, the comment was finding doctors to work there. And workforce issues, particularly for rural community health centers, have long and always been an issue and a problem. It's been less of an issue, less of a problem for the urban facility, but particularly for the rural facility, it's been a real problem. And the solution to that problem for the first 10, 15, 20 years of the program was largely the National Health Service Corps, which we're going to be talking about more in a couple of weeks when we do workforce issues. The National Health Service Corps is a program under which the federal government, and there are some state health service corps programs which replicate it or are similar to it, but these programs are essentially programs in which either the federal government or the states gives either grants or low-interest loans to medical students and or other providers in exchange for a commitment to work after graduation for a couple of years in a medically underserved community. And there was a period, I would say, in the late 1970s when over 50% of the doctors in the nation's community health centers had come through the National Health Service Corps pipeline. So the facilities were very dependent on the NHSC, but there were always workforce issues, and so that's a very good point. What other kinds of issues do you think might have been problematic in the first 10, 15 years? You're running one of these programs. You're the CEO of a community health center. Yeah.
Adequate funding
was probably the biggest problem they had. Now, the idea, the theory, was that these programs would be funded through a variety of sources. Source number one would be federal grants. Source number two would be to the extent that the patients who came to the clinics had third-party insurance, particularly Medicaid, that Medicaid would help finance the community health centers. And then source number three would be whatever grants, you know, private grants they could lay their hands on. Turned out those first 10, 15 years that community health centers got a lot less money from Medicaid than they thought they were going to get. A lot less than they thought they were going to get. One problem was that Medicaid nationally was costing much more than the creators of Medicaid thought it was going to cost. And so there was a big effort to cut Medicaid rates, and community health center rates got slashed. Indeed, federal Medicaid law required that hospitals get their reasonable costs, whatever they spent, but that's the only provider that early on had that sort of most favored provider status. And so if a state had to give the hospitals whatever they were charging, there wasn't a whole lot left over for community-based providers such as community health centers. Another problem around Medicaid that community health centers had was that many of the community health centers relied upon a model under which much of the care was and is delivered by non-physician providers, by physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, nurses, and the like. Early on, in that first 10, 15, 20-year period, many states did not provide reimbursement for these non-physician providers. Another problem with Medicaid was that Medicaid was strictly a health care insurance program, and many of the kinds of services that these community health centers provided were more social services than health care services. Everything from transportation to case management to social services of a variety of sorts. And so Medicaid refused to pay a lot of those social service costs. Because, again, these health centers viewed themselves as a lot more than simply medical care centers. They viewed themselves as health writ large centers, taking care of the whole person, providing whatever services, whatever needs that person had. So there was a lot less money from Medicaid than they thought they'd have. There was also less money in federal grants than they thought they'd have, because Richard Nixon becomes president in 1968. And he decides he doesn't want to spend as much on grants to community-based health facilities as Lyndon Johnson had been spending. So there's less federal money than they expected. That's one problem. What other kinds of problems do you think the health centers might have had? Well, that's interesting. The comment was maybe the population didn't know enough about them to utilize the services. And I think what happened, and I think you're onto something there, that what happened is the population of private pay patients, even working class private pay patients, either didn't know about them or decided not to go to them, the community health centers, because there was a stigma that was soon attached to them. Whereas the Medicaid patients and the uninsured patients often went there because they had no other place to go, particularly for any sort of primary care. And so many of these facilities around the country began seeing far more uninsured patients than they expected, than they ever expected to see. So they had fewer paying patients and more uninsured patients. So that was another problem. What else do you think? Yeah. Hospitals hated these facilities, these community health centers. Hospitals viewed them as direct competitors. And what hospitals would do early on in the 60s and 70s was refuse to give privileges, hospital privileges, to the doctors in the community health centers. Now, the second comment that was just made was that hospitals also began creating their own hospital-based clinics. That phenomena actually came later, largely in response to Medicaid-managed care and sort of the changes in the healthcare system in the 1990s and the changes in the hospital. But clearly, the point was that the hospitals, and particularly in low-income communities, were the established infrastructure. And the community health centers were the pesky, annoying interlopers, you know. And the hospitals wanted to do everything they could to sort of stamp these places out. Yeah?
If the community health centers were seeing so many uninsured patients, why was the hospital concerned? Did they really feel like they were losing money?
Well, I think they were concerned because, for a couple of reasons. One, because they thought there was a potential of competition. Two, because there was an assumption that a lot of these facilities, which relied upon non-physician providers, they relied upon a lot of foreign-trained physicians. There was sort of this elitist attitude that a lot of the academic medical centers had that said the quality of care could not be nearly as good as it is in all facilities. And I think because many of these community health centers were overtly, particularly in the 60s and 70s, were overtly political. I mean, they viewed themselves as challenging the established infrastructure, both health and income and other, in these communities. They viewed the hospitals often as the enemy themselves. It wasn't just that the hospitals hated the community health centers. The community health centers often hated the hospitals. And the community health centers were run by very inexperienced managers. They were run by folks right out of schools of public health. I mean, it was if you guys, you know, I mean, imagine. That's a scary thought, you know. You know, you finish here and you go out and you're running a community health center. And what am I trying to say? No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. No, my point is, I really am kidding, but my point is they were inexperienced managers who had very sort of strong ideals and viewed themselves as challenging the local political infrastructure. And that created conflict. And that created political conflict. They also viewed themselves as challenging the local political infrastructure, not just the local hospital infrastructure. And remember, local governments were also excluded from these funding streams by the federal government. So local officials were not thrilled with this. And the one course that in the School of Public Health that some of these early CHC leaders might not have taken or might not have paid attention to was strategic management. I don't know how many of you have taken strategic management, but you know, they were less interested in creating strategic plans and five-year plans and figuring out how to maximize revenue, and they were more interested in providing social service, you know, to the community. And so they had a strategic plan, if they had one, that really said, we're going to provide everything to everybody. So you had clinics that were providing everything to everybody, were getting less money than they thought, had political conflicts with local hospitals, had political conflicts with local political officials, had relatively inexperienced managers. And yet, despite all of these caveats, study after study after study after study was demonstrating that the actual quality of care, the quality of health care in these facilities was pretty darn good. People were getting good care. So it wasn't a question of that, but there were all of these other financial and political issues, and so many of these health centers went bankrupt, went under, and by the mid-late 70s, it seemed like this was an idea whose time had come and gone. Lo and behold, however, by the mid-80s, health centers were very hot again. Was there a question? Did you have a question? Yeah, comment, question? That's a very good point. I mean, there was a huge immigrant influx, particularly in low-income communities. And for those of you who couldn't hear, the comment was, you know, didn't some of the changing demographics and the rapid influx of immigrants, particularly from Latin communities, also begin to overwhelm many of these understaffed, under-resourced facilities? And the answer is yes to that as well. Mid-late 80s, however, there's a sea shift. First of all, and this is true even today, and it was true in the mid-late 80s, many of the relatively inexperienced managers who worked in these health centers in the late 60s and early 70s were still there in the late 80s. In fact, many of them are still there in the early 2000s today. That first generation of health center leadership is just now beginning to retire, you know, 40 years into the program. And those relatively inexperienced managers in the mid-late 60s, by the mid-late 80s, had become pretty sophisticated, had figured out they needed to mend fences with local politicians, they needed to mend fences with local hospital officials, they needed to be a part of the local medical culture, local medical community. But probably they'd begun to realize, you know, to use again the old cliche, no money, no mission. You know, you can't have a mission-driven organization that can't survive financially. They'd begun to figure out how to work Medicaid. They'd begun to figure out how to work state officials. And then most dramatically, most importantly, most fundamentally key to the changed fortunes of the community health centers in the late 1980s was the decision by Congress in the late 1980s to require states, a mandate to require that states provide community health centers with cost-based reimbursement. So literally overnight, these facilities went from a situation in which they were getting, say, 40 to 50% of their costs from states to a situation in which overnight they were getting 100% of their costs. Now there was a huge, and in addition to that, Medicaid was reimbursing for the non-physician providers. Medicaid was reimbursing for a lot of the case management, transportation, and other kinds of ancillary services. It was really the late 80s, early 90s were in many respects really the glory days, or the first set of glory days for many of these community health centers around the country. They had savvy leaders. They had enough money to do what they needed to do. They were established in the community. They were providing good quality care. They could take care of the uninsured in their community, or at least a certain number of the uninsured in their community, with the Medicaid dollars they were receiving. So late 80s, early 90s was a pretty good time for these facilities. Again, though, and one of my goals here is just to show you how the fortunes of these facilities, and you could do this for almost any kind of healthcare facility, how the fortunes of these facilities have really waned back and forth and back and forth. So if the late 80s and early 90s were sort of time of glory for these facilities, or at least time of financial security and everything seems hunky-dory, by the mid-1990s, they were in big trouble again. By the mid-90s, they were in big trouble again. One problem they had in the mid-90s was that Bill Clinton became president in the early 90s, and Bill Clinton, among other things, decided he wanted to ease mandates on the states. And so Clinton, among other things, said, we're going to phase out the requirement that states provide cost-based reimbursement to community health centers. So that was one problem. An even bigger problem that the community health centers had in the early mid-1990s, the even bigger fear that the community health centers had in the early mid-1990s was Medicaid managed care. So now let me just talk for a few minutes about Medicaid managed care to sort of set the stage for community health centers and Medicaid managed care. Throughout the 1960s and 1970s and early 1980s even, and late 1980s even, most states simply ran traditional fee-for-service Medicaid programs in which Medicaid beneficiaries got a card. They could use that card to access any doctor who would accept that card. Relatively few doctors accepted the card, so the Medicaid beneficiary would end up getting their care in the emergency room or perhaps at one of these clinics. Mid-1990s, states across the country say to themselves, we want to convert our Medicaid beneficiaries from fee-for-service Medicaid to managed care plans. We want to transition our Medicaid beneficiaries, particularly into commercial health plans. Now, why is that dangerous, potentially dangerous for a community health center? What's the problem there for a community health center? Yeah.
Well, if they're in commercial health plans, then technically they have access to kind of the competitors of the community health center. So they have access to the hospitals and access to...
And the hospital-based clinics, for example, as we were just... Right. So the fear is, now remember, the Medicaid beneficiary by the early 1990s for the community health center, that Medicaid beneficiary is golden. Is golden. I mean, that's the revenue that the health center has that comes in through that Medicaid beneficiary. But the fear is if all of these Medicaid beneficiaries start signing up with Oxford, Prudential, Blue Cross, Aetna, you know, and PacifiCare, what happens if the Medicaid beneficiaries who sign up with those plans select somebody else as their primary care network, as their primary care doctor, whether it's a hospital-based clinic, whether it's an office-based physician, whoever it is, the health centers start to worry and, in fact, start to see some of their patients migrating away, some of their prize golden paying patients migrating away from the health facility, the health clinic, to other providers. So you're potentially losing your key revenue maximizing enhancing folks. And that's really dangerous. So what do you do? You're running a community health center. What are your options in that kind of environment? Anybody? Yeah.
You market yourself to the insurers for a discounted rate, so if you're losing money, there is to get some of it.
So one option is you could say, we ought to sign contracts. We, the community health center, better sign contracts with Prudential, Blue Cross, and Aetna, so that we're in their network. But the trouble is, just because you sign a contract doesn't mean you're going to sign a good contract. And the Aetnas and the Oxfords of the world were not interested in paying cost-based reimbursement to these health centers. So if they were going to sign them, they were going to sign them for less than cost-based reimbursement, and then the health centers were going to get less money than they were getting previously for these Medicaid patients, at least if the state allowed and the federal government allowed that to happen. So one option, and you could also end up with patients, you know, you can end up with the hardest-to-serve patients from that health insurance company and sort of lose even the easier-to-serve patients that could get adversely selected elsewhere. So that's one option. What's the second option? Anybody read Uneasy Alliances, the article for today? This class, Issues and Approaches, Health Policy Management? No cynicism there. You could start your own health plan. You could say, we want to form a health plan. I wrote that damn article and you didn't even read it. It's all right. You could say, we want to form our own health plan. And we want to compete with Oxford and we want to compete with Aetna. We're going to, in effect, create our own health plan to compete in the Medicaid managed care market. Except creating a health plan is not so easy. Number one, it takes a lot of money. You gotta have a lot of money to put into, you know, to meet state capitalization and reserve requirements. You gotta have enrollment systems. You have to have marketing systems. You have to have QA systems. You have to have insurance. I mean, you have to become an insurance company. Yeah. The comment was, for those who couldn't hear it, if by the mid-90s the health centers are not needed anymore, why didn't, in effect, they just fold up 10 and say, we're closing and let the money go elsewhere? And what do you think the community health center official would say in response to that? Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And also, I mean, community health centers can provide a lot of services that hospitals do.
Okay. Anybody else? So one argument was they were needed to provide for the uninsured. Another argument was they provided services that weren't provided elsewhere. A third argument that the community health center official would say is, you know what, we actually provide better quality care, you know, than else, and we're an important part of our local community. On the other hand, if indeed the community health center could not make it financially, I mean, if indeed they really were going to go under financially, then there was no Chrysler bailout program for them. I mean, you know, they, if they could not figure out a way to survive financially, they would have gone bankrupt, and some did. So it's not as if there was somebody at the federal government saying, we're going to make sure that every community health center survives. The question was for those in local communities that were providing a service to that community, could they figure out a way to survive and thrive and provide services in this changing environment? I don't know if that answers your question. If you want to ask, is there... Okay. So one problem with these plans forming their own health plan, and we're going to come back to your point in a second, because it's interesting what happens over time to community health centers. But one problem is it's expensive to form a health plan. And so what do many of the community health centers begin to do in order to afford to create a health plan? They enter alliances, thus the article Uneasy Alliances. they create alliances with other safety net providers, either with other health centers, with public hospitals, with public health clinics, with other safety net providers. Except these alliances, and the reason we call the alliances uneasy alliances, is there's a lot of pitfalls in creating a health insurance plan with other alliances. And so, for example, in the article, we talk a lot about and use as an example the case of a health plan formed in Colorado called Colorado Access. Colorado Access was formed by a coalition of community health centers, Denver General Hospital, the University Hospital, the University of Colorado, and the Children's Hospital in Denver also. So you have three big hospital systems, you know, the public hospital system, the University Hospital system, and the Children's Hospital system, that all view themselves as safety net providers entering into an alliance with the state's community health centers to create a managed care plan. Each of those four sponsoring entities, Children's, University, Denver General, and the CHCs, had a 25% vote on the board of directors of Colorado Access. The hospitals basically came up with the money. They had the money. The community health centers didn't have the money. The hospitals had the money. The community health centers had the patients. They had the beneficiaries, the patients. So it seemed like a alliance made in heaven. It seemed like it was, you know, no problems. Except you're now, what kind of, either if you read the article or if you didn't read the article, what kind of issues, problems, conflicts do you think are likely to arise in that kind of alliance, in that kind of health plan, in that kind of setting? Yeah.
I think that the hospitals felt like they were subsidizing the community health center.
So the hospitals say to themselves, geez, we're putting up all the money. What are we getting out of this deal? Okay, so the way they worked it is, the comment was, the question was, it's hard to decide who's in charge. And that becomes, there's two kinds of conflicts that I want to talk about here that came up. One kind of conflict that came up was between this health plan that they created, Colorado Access, and the four sponsoring entities. And then the second kind of conflict is between the four sponsoring entities themselves. Let me first talk about conflicts between the health plan and the sponsors. You're the CEO of Colorado Access. You've been created by these four sponsors. They've each put up, and it doesn't have to be those four in Colorado. Here in New York, for example, Harlem Hospital, North General Hospital, and Columbia Presbyterian, those three hospitals each put up money to create a managed care plan, Community Premier Plus, or whatever it is. So you got three hospitals that put up money. And, or in the Colorado case, you've got, you know, these three hospital systems plus the CHCs. And what they do with that money is they actually create an entity called Colorado Access with a corporate entity, with the CEO, with the CFO, with a QA person, with an MIS person, with a marketing person. You know, they create a functioning insurance program, managed care plan. And so you're the CEO of that program, of that managed care plan. On your board of directors, though, you've got three votes for Children's Hospital, three votes University, three votes Denver General, three votes Community Health Center. You sit in your office one day, minding your own business, and the phone rings. And you pick up the phone, you get the picture here, you pick up the phone, and it's the local Columbia HCA Hospital. You know, it's the big for-profit hospital in Denver. And they say to you, you know what, Mr. CEO, you know what, in your managed care plan that you've got, all of you, you're paying for all of these women on Medicaid to deliver their babies in University Hospital, Children's Hospital, or Denver General. And those are three pretty darn expensive hospitals, and it's costing you $100 a delivery. I mean, that's obviously not the right amount, but just say $100 a delivery. We here at Columbia HCA, we could take your standard non-high risk, non-difficult, you know, the high risk stuff. I mean, we admit if there's a woman who's really high risk and there's danger involved, send her to University Hospital. That's where she belongs. You know, she belongs at the, you know, the fanciest, best place. But if it's just basically your typical low risk, easy case, you send her to one of our, to our Columbia HCA facility, we are just as good as any of those three for your standard, you know. In fact, we might even be better. We have a new birthing room. You know, we've got all this new snazzy stuff. We've got these new nurse practitioners, and we're cheaper. And the women will like it. They'll be happier. And so you say, you're now the head of this managed care plan. And you say to yourself, geez, let me first call up my QA guy and see whether or not he thinks this hospital really can, you know, deliver babies just as well as any of these other hospitals for low cost. And the QA guy goes, you know what? I was there last week. They've got this state-of-the-art, you know, delivery stuff. They're really pretty good. You know, again, we don't want to send our high-risk kids there, parents, but for the basic moms, you know, we're much better off sending them there. And so you say, all right, maybe I should enter a contract with Columbia HCA. Because I'm going to save a lot of money. It's going to be, you know, it's going to cost me half as much money, and it's going to be just as good quality. What's the problem, though? Who's the next phone call you're going to get from? The four people that hired you. You know, University Hospital, Children's Hospital, and Denver General, they're going to say, what do you think this is, friggin' Frankenstein, you know, that we've created this monster here that's going to go out and just enter into, you know, we created you as a defensive mechanism to protect us in the marketplace. I mean, I remember interviewing folks here at Community Premier Plus, and I don't want to give away too much, particularly because it's local, but, you know, the hospital itself was willing to subsidize a loss to keep the patients coming, you know, to keep those systems coming into this, into Columbia Presbyterian, for example, or into Denver General. So when that CEO goes to his board of directors or her board of directors and says, I want to enter into a contract with Columbia HCA, there's a very good chance that the board of directors is going to say no. So there's a, and now, when the board of directors, now this is a management question. When that board of directors is sitting in that room, and they walk into the room, what hat are they wearing? Presumably, they're supposed to be wearing their hat as the board member of the Board of Directors for Colorado Access, which is an independent, functioning managed care plan. On the other hand, they're also wearing their hat as the CFO or the CEO for University Hospital. There is a clear conflict of interest that the board members have wearing their hat as both the board of directors of the managed care plan and the board of directors of their particular hospital in this particular case. And it's a real dilemma as to what that board should do and how that board should act in that kind of situation. Does the board do what's best for the health plan as a health plan, or does the board do what's best for the sponsors of that health plan, which created it and gave it money initially so that it could survive, so that they could continue to have Medicaid patients guaranteed coming to their community health centers or to their children's hospital? Clear conflicts there. There's also clear conflicts between the community health centers, say, and the hospitals, who are both part of the plan. Again, the example we used in the article was, how does the health plan pay for primary care? The community health centers basically said, you know what, you should capitate us at a pretty low rate. We provide pretty good, pretty cheap care. And if you capitate us at a low rate, you, the health plan, will do okay because you don't have to pay a lot and we'll be fine. University Hospital says, geez, if you capitate us for primary care, you're going to be paying us way below cost. Way below cost. And just because that, you know, little rural health clinic in, you know, rural Colorado could do it for, you know, $10, we here at University can't do it for $10. So maybe pay them $10 if you want, but if you're going to pay, you know, you have to pay us more. And then the health center says, well, wait a minute, why should the hospital get more for providing the exact same primary care services as we get for providing those primary care services, just because we do it more cheaply and more efficiently and better? And so inevitably, in these provider-sponsored health plans, and you see whether it's in a safety net health plan or in a non-safety net health plan, in a provider-sponsored health plan, there are inevitably conflicts of interest that arise between the providers and the health plans. Okay. So, mid-80s, the story is, well, early 90s, the story is states across the country want to do Medicaid managed care. They want to get the commercial plans in the market. In response to the commercial plans entering the market, the safety net providers get scared and start forming their own safety net health plans as a defensive mechanism with all the issues and problems that I just talked about. And then a third entity enters the market, and these are for-profit commercial Medicaid-only health plans. I mean, the commercial health plan, again, serves both Medicaid patients, commercial patients, Medicare patients. They serve everybody. Medicaid is just one line in their line of business. The Medicaid only, then the safety net health plans are those plans formed by safety net providers. And then the commercial Medicaid only plans are these for-profit entities just that are created to enter the Medicaid managed care market. So you have these three different kinds of health plans entering the Medicaid managed care marketplace in the early mid-90s. So from the state's perspective, all of a sudden in the early mid-90s, things are looking pretty darn good because you've now got all of these health plans competing for the business. You've got the Oxfords and the Aetnas and the Prudentials competing for your business. You have the Colorado Accesses and the Community Premier Pluses and the Health Firsts and all the safety net health plans competing for your business. And then you have all these commercial Medicaid-only plans competing for your business. So you've got this thriving, vibrant marketplace of health plans competing for the business of the Medicaid managed care beneficiary. So that's the way the world looks in the early mid-90s. Any questions so far on this? Yeah.
So just to clarify, like, does the were meant to be Medicaid providers?
They were meant, not providers, Medicaid plans.
Yeah, right. They were meant to be.
They were meant to compete.
So
now,
they
put in bids equally with everybody else. Now, they don't. They didn't necessarily have to limit themselves to the Medicaid market. And one of the big questions that many of these health plans, these newly created health plans, had asked themselves when they were sitting in the board of directors room is, do we want to just bid for Medicaid business, or do we want to also bid for, you know, working class private insurance, you know, in our neighborhoods, in our communities? Do we want to also bid for prison health services? Do we want to also bid for special needs plans of a variety of sorts? Do we want to also bid for Medicaid, to be a Medicaid drug plan? I mean, you know, for, you know, what's our mission? And how do we accomplish that mission? And do we spread ourselves thin? Do we concentrate just on Medicaid? I mean, all those are tough kinds of questions that these health plans had to think about when they were trying to come up with their strategic plans for how they were going to survive and thrive in this world. Okay, so now it's mid-1990s, and you're a state official. And you can't believe your good luck. You know, you decided you were going to do this Medicaid managed care initiative. You had no idea who was going to participate. You had no idea if Oxford was going to participate. And all of a sudden, not only do you have Oxford, but you got Colorado Access, you got the Medicaid-only commercial plan. You have this thriving marketplace. Except the one problem you have is you're not saving any money. And the reason you're not saving any money is that almost without exception, in the early 90s, in order to lure the commercial plans into the marketplace, because again, there was this assumption, if we get Oxford in the marketplace, you know, that's heaven. So if we, how do we lure Oxford into the marketplace, into the Medicaid marketplace? Well, we have to pay pretty high rates. And so the Medicaid plans in the early, mid-90s across the country are paying pretty generous rates to lure the commercial plans into the market. But then, so the commercial plans have been lured into the market. The safety net plans and the commercial Medicaid-only plans have now also entered the market. And now the state officials say to themselves, by the mid-90s, they say to themselves, geez, this is great. We have this thriving marketplace, but we're not saving any money. In fact, we're spending more money because we've got these generous rates to all these plans. Why don't we cut the rates? Why don't we cut the rates? We have 20 plans competing. Maybe we'll put out a competitive bid, you know, and say we're just going to, you know, it's going to be the marketplace at work. Say we're just going to accept, you know, low bids, top, you know, lowest 8 bids of the really good health plans. You know, there's 20 plans competing. We'll get 8, you know, low bids. We'll also, you know, really try to do some good regulatory oversight. We'll become prudent purchasers. So by the mid-90s, the state officials begin to say to themselves, what we should be is more prudent marketplace purchasers. And that's the hat that the state officials begin to wear. And you see this in New York State, for example. George Pataki. I mean, during the 80s, Mario Cuomo's the governor. You know, there's a little Medicaid managed care. Early 90s, there's a little Medicaid managed care. It's kind of inching along. It's all voluntary. Nothing very much is going on. 1991, there's a bigger initiative under Cuomo. There's more managed care, but again, you know, relatively small. George Pataki becomes governor in 1994, 95, and he says, you know what, we're going to do mandatory managed care, we're going to do it overnight, and we're going to do competitive bidding. We're going to have more, we're going to require all Medicaid beneficiaries in New York State to be enrolled in a managed care plan, but we're going to do competitive bidding, so we're going to lower the cost. Except what happens? The commercial plans say, you know, this was all fine and good when you were paying us a lot of money. But first of all, turned out this is a lot tougher than we thought it was. You know, it's tougher to create the kind of networks that we wanted to create in low-income communities. It's tougher to deal with some of the hard-to-treat Medicaid beneficiaries. Some of our doctors have complained. We've got all these, all of a sudden, we've got all these community, you know, activist advocacy organizations on our backs all the time, and they're a real pain in the neck. Plus, what else is going on in the mid-90s, in the managed care commercial world more generally? These commercial plans are in big trouble. They're no longer the darling of Wall Street. They're in big trouble with their commercial business. And so a lot of these health plans in the mid-late 90s start saying to themselves, you know, Medicaid just ain't worth it. You know, states are slashing the rates. They're imposing more and more regulatory requirements, more and more oversight. The advocates are killing us. You know, all of this is for like 5% of our business. Meanwhile, in the other 90% of our business, which is our commercial markets, we're having all sorts of trouble with GM. Let's just forget about this, you know, Medicaid business. Let's concentrate on making GM happy or working with our big commercial customers. Let's get back to our core businesses and sort of, because government, you know, first they raised the rates in the early 90s, then they lower the rates now. They're unstable. They're unpredictable. Who knows what the heck is going to happen with government. So a lot of the big managed care plans in the late 90s say we're gone, and they pull out of the market. So who does that leave in the market? That leaves a lot of these safety net health plans and a lot of the Medicaid-only plans. All right. Now let's switch back to the community health centers. The community health centers have, during the mid-90s, they were really in trouble. They thought they were in trouble. So they were creating these safety net health plans, and they also began to go to Congress. And they said, you know what? We perform a valuable service in low-income communities. And you know what? We provide a tool to help the uninsured that's pretty cheap, that's pretty easy, that's pretty cost-effective. And Congress says, you know what? I think you're right. And George Bush in the early 2000s says, you know what? I think you're right. And so all of a sudden, in the early 2000s, Congress changes the law again and reinserts cost-based reimbursement for community health centers. Now, at first there was no cost-based reimbursement, then there was cost-based reimbursement, then cost-based reimbursement was being phased out, then it's put back in. So all of a sudden, cost-based reimbursement is back in, and all of a sudden there's this, and all of a sudden the commercial managed care plans are pulling out of the markets left and right. State health officials say to themselves, you know what, we really need these safety net health plans. The safety net health plans say, well, you know what, these rate cuts, you know, the rate cuts hurt us as much as they did Oxford, except we're not pulling out because this is our core business. But if you want us to stay afloat, you have to raise the rates to us. So the states say, all right, maybe we should raise the rates. And so again, you see it back and forth. First, the rates were really high, early 90s, then the rates were really low, mid-late 90s. Early 2000s, the state Medicaid agencies start paying high rates again. They were also hoping to lure back some of the commercial health plans, but the commercial health plans, by and large, say, you know what, it's too unstable. We don't want to get involved. So now the community health centers and the safety net health plans are doing pretty well financially. They're getting cost-based reimbursement again. And George Bush and Ted Kennedy agree that the community health centers are the best thing since sliced bread in terms of quality and services in low-income communities. So all of a sudden there's this bipartisan support for community health centers. So again, it's this down and up and down and up and down and up situation with community health centers, with safety net health plans in the Medicaid managed care market. It's this very unstable up and down. Very unstable up and down. And so today, in 2006, I mean, let me just give you a couple of examples in terms of numbers. In 1998, community health centers across the nation served around 8 million people. And that number had risen a lot in the mid-90s. By last year, that number was up to 14 million. And it's been rising, you know, about 2-3 million a year. And then when you add to that the hospital-based clinics that have arisen as hospitals have realized that this community-based model is now really the way to go. The delivery system itself is really beginning to fundamentally change. On the other hand, if you run a community health center today in 2006, what do you worry about? What are some of the things you worry about? Yeah. You worry about cuts. You worry, you know what? You say, geez, I've been working at this health center for 25 years, and I've seen the money go up, and I've seen it go down, and I've seen it go up, and I've seen it go down. And we have to be prepared for the fact that in a tough revenue environment, when state and federal governments are looking to save money, community health centers could be a place that gets cut. We can't just assume that sort of this gravy train is going to keep on going and this sort of, you know, this bipartisan enamoration with us is going to continue forever. You've also got a growing number of uninsured. You've got, you know, 45, 50 million uninsured folks who are increasingly looking to these community health centers as their primary source of care. And then you've also got a dilemma if you run one of these health centers in that you want to provide the services that people need. And yet you say to yourself, well, should I, in my community health center, be starting a pharmacy? You know, should I be in the business of handing out, you know, prescription drugs to people and selling prescription drugs to people? Is that a business I want and should go into? Should I begin hiring some specialty care folks so that I do more than just provide primary care? I actually begin to provide specialty care. Is that moving away from my core niche? Is that moving away from my mission? Is that spreading myself too thin? Or is that serving the community in a way that the community needs to be served that I can afford to do at this point? I mean, these are very tough issues. And they're tough issues whether you're running a federally qualified community health center or a non-federally qualified community health center. You know, do you focus in, you know, how narrow do you define your niche? In these safety net health plans, you know, right now the safety net health plans are doing fairly well financially in most states. The expectation is, particularly with government funding, there's going to be a real cycle there. Lots of ups, lots of downs. Part of the reason I wanted to walk you through all this is because when we were talking about the uninsured, I did make a point of emphasizing the current bipartisan consensus that this model is a good model and that it's a model that deserves to be funded, and it's been receiving all sorts of expanded funding of a variety of sorts, and it sort of works for both those who say we don't have to worry about the uninsured because they've got the health centers and those who say we have to worry about the uninsured but we want to still finance needed facilities. From the perspective of the manager of one of these facilities, you've got a lot to think about and a lot to worry about in terms of what your mission is and what you can accomplish and how you can accomplish it. Any questions on any of this so far? All right. What I had been planning on doing, except I thought we'd be here about half an hour ago, was walking through some specific administrative tasks, administrative decisions that public managers have to make when they're thinking about running any sort of health initiative, such as a managed care initiative. You know, what beneficiaries do you cover? What kind of rates do you pay? How do you figure out those rates? How do you ensure quality of care? You know, all those kinds of, you know, issue after issue. And that's what the breakout sessions are going to be about next week. So maybe what we'll do, even though you'll all be very sad to go home early, maybe we'll stop now. And then next week what I'll do is sort of the first half, we'll sort of put long-term care off sort of 1 week. And next week what I'll do is the first half will be sort of on managing a managed care initiative. Then we'll have the breakout session, and then we'll do long-term care the week after. Yeah.
Here.